I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, taking the measure of 9/11 effects in our world, in our heads, with the best-selling psychologist Steven Pinker and the decorated diplomat and strategist Chaz Freeman. A decade and a half out, are we a different country? But first, here's what the people say and how they helped define the question at Downtown Crossing this week.
I think that if you could go back to the 80s or the 90s and tell people the sort of measures we'd get used to, they'd think you were crazy.
Obviously, since 9/11, a lot has changed. For example, the marathon, which is coming up, you can't have certain packages, you can't have backpacks. I mean, it's affecting the whole country in general. Unfortunately, it's a necessary evil. I mean, you have to do it because you got to protect everybody. Unfortunately, what's happened in the past, we have no choice.
It's completely different because there's not, for one thing, enough humanitarianism in this country. There really, really isn't. People have gotten scared, and they got to be brave.
I think it had an impact on the world. It's not just America. The whole world was affected by 9/11. The concern about terrorism has become a global phenomenon, so I don't think the world has gotten over it. The world changed because of that, and I don't think we're going back.
We speak of 9/11 as a turning point that changed the world, but did it change us? Is there any comparing the post-traumatic symptoms that came, say, of our Civil War, of the Depression, of World Wars I and II, or the might-have-been apocalyptic Cold War? Any comparison of those things with the memory of a sneak attack on Lower Manhattan that took 3,000 and some American lives 12-plus years ago? How are we dealing with the injury, individually and together? Our phone is 800-423-8255. Steven Pinker is a princely writer on the cognitive sciences, on how the mind works. His last big book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, argued that the big trend in human affairs is the decline of violence. Dr. Pinker, read the symptoms. How is the collective mind working on 9/11 now, do you think?
Well, 9/11 interrupted a very pleasant narrative that we had been enjoying up to that point. Historians often will earmark certain years as transitions in the international system. You know, 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, that's when Europe got divided into states and each state had sovereignty. 1789 with the French Revolution, 1917 with the Russian Revolution. We were kind of living in an era that seemed to be demarcated by 1989, the peaceful collapse of communism. And it was a great time in the 90s, as you recall, at least in the late 90s, when the spasms of the breakup of the Soviet Union had started to settle down, when it looked as if repressed people everywhere were yearning for freedom and that all you had to do was topple a dictator and people would embrace liberal democracy. 9/11 kind of shattered that process, at least for a while. I don't think we are far enough away from it to know what new era it brought on. The idea that it was heralding a clash of civilizations didn't make a whole lot of sense because most of the conflicts that came afterwards were not did not divide up as Western civilization versus Islamic civilization. There were a lot of the bloodshed was Islamic versus Islamic, with Western civilizations allied with many Islamic states and movements. So that wasn't a very tidy way of organizing the world. And I think we don't really understand what the new narrative is. In fact, when the Arab Spring broke out, at least for a few months before it all went sour, it looked like the great liberal dream of 1989 was taking place after all, that it was just a few despots that were preventing this pent-up demand for liberal democracy. I think the reality is probably that narratives are going to fail us because there are different people, different groups who want different things. There is no such thing as a monolithic Islamic civilization. There is some big chunk that really does want liberal democracy. Whether they are a plurality or a bare but suppressed majority or a splinter probably varies from country to country. Between the fundamentalists, the military dictators, the liberal Democrats, I think you just got a very unstable situation, and the tensions there are obviously drawing in the rest of the world.
Steve Pinker, take this thing in our heads apart. You've written about the terror mindset in our heads, in our lives. And let me just say first, it's a joy to see you on the radio again. And also that ever since we saw our way back to the radio, I've been wanting to ask this question, and of you too. What is this thing we're going through? Is it PTSD? Is it a kind of numbness? Are we stuck in it? Is it torpor? Is it patience? Is it, I don't know, just living with pain or what?
I don't know if we're stuck, because the world now is very different than the world in a couple of years after 9/11, where it seemed like a good idea to do something like invade Iraq, which we now
not
see
to me,
was just mad.
Say. Probably not to you either.
No, but to an awful lot of people who were otherwise you'd think would be trustworthy, a lot of on the liberal left thought it was a great idea. And now we say, you know, what could they have been thinking? They're just we aren't willing to intervene in places like Syria and Libya, where maybe a humanitarian case could be made, but we're just not going to do that. Or Ukraine, for example. So I think that there's been changes since 9/11. Now, you brought up terrorism and what is our psychological reaction to terrorism. Now, the interesting thing about terrorism is the word itself refers to a human emotion. And so it's unlike other military political movements. It's like other weapons in that it pertains to a psychological state, namely fear. And terrorism, of course, is the leveraging of a little bit of violence to generate an awful lot of fear. And clearly, I think by any rational standard, there was a massive overreaction compared to the size of the threat. 9/11 was the biggest terrorist attack in history by far. No other terrorist event was even broke 1,000, let alone 3,000. And that's been true ever since as well. What I think we're seeing psychologically is a version of Daniel Kahneman's availability heuristic. Namely, we are wired to judge risk and danger by memorable events. We don't do the statistics. The fact that the number of people killed in 9/11 is a minuscule fraction of the people who die from all kinds of other causes, including, you know, drownings, falling off ladders, homicides, there's just no comparison. There are 16,000 homicides a year in this country. But because it got so much attention, it was so unforgettable, so vivid, it colors our risk, our perception of how risky the world we live in is. And terrorists know that. That's why they commit acts of terror. They are generally weak agents who try to gain publicity precisely because people overestimate the actual impact of terrorist events.
But let's also remember the U.S. government, you know, was thinking the same logic when we called the invasion of Iraq shock and awe. We'll give them something to remember. We'll scare the wits out of them, you know, in the first night or two of thunderous bombing.
Although we did a lot of actual damage, too.
Yes.
That wasn't just there was something behind the terror in that case.
Right. But it comes back to, well, two things. You're a scientist who likes to err on the side of the quantitative. Can I measure it? Is there a number for it? What's the trend? How do you calibrate that thing called fear in our society today? Where do you look for it? How do you measure? Yeah.
One thing to do is just put it in perspective of the other risks that we live with, such as death on the highway, such as homicide, such as electrocutions and fires. Now, of course, looking out on the scale of possible damage, there probably is some reason to worry about things like nuclear terrorism, which really could it's unlikely, but the impact could be so catastrophic that it's worth giving some thought to making sure it doesn't happen, and to the worst forms of bioterror. But conventional terrorism just doesn't really kill a whole lot of people. The other interesting thing about terrorism when considered quantitatively is that it doesn't work. Now, there's a widespread belief that you can't really blame disenfranchised groups. What else are they going to do? This is the only way that they can get what they want. But that's people who have actually tallied the success rate of terrorist movements have found that it is about maybe 3% if you're generous. That the and if it,
three, first 3% what?
Get any of their strategic aims.
Ah.
Generally, the only aims that they can get are sometimes expelling foreign troops, like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Independence movements, secessionist movements that are driven by terrorism never get what they want. That's why Quebec is part of Canada and Basque Country is part of Spain. And there's no Tamil state in Sri Lanka. Puerto Rico is still an American Commonwealth. Northern Ireland is part of the UK. There's no independent Palestine. Case after case of failure, despite the fact that people are under the – and especially terrorists are obviously under the impression that this must be a good tactic, which it isn't.
Come back to this matter of the U.S. government's overreaction, but also this matter of the narrative, the explanation we were given. I mean, I still – more than ever, I think, honor Susan Sontag's piece in The New Yorker immediately on the – when all sorts of celebrity writers, John Updike, Aaron Ehrenfeld, many others, or a number of others, commented in The New Yorker. And she was furious, unmistakably, about what she called last Tuesday's monstrous dose – the disconnect between last Tuesday's monstrous dose of reality and the self-righteous drivel and outright deceptions being peddled by public figures and TV commentators. It was startling, she said. It was depressing. And the basic line was, coming from the President of the United States too, was that they hate us for our freedom and for who we are, when there was a probably a much better case to be made for the thought that they hate us for what we do, especially in their parts of the world. But the narrative set in that, you know, why do they hate us? They hate us because we're free, because we play baseball, because, you know, it's red, white, and blue, or something. But I, to me, that's the question we still haven't gone back to, is reconsidering the narrative. What was this all about?
The question is how much is there a single coherent motive? I think probably some of them do hate our freedoms, or some of them take it as an affront that there are American troops on Islamic soil, such as in Saudi Arabia. There is a great culture of honor that it is an intolerable affront for there to be any kind of compromise in Islamic civilization. There probably is not a single motive, is my guess.
We're talking about the 9/11 effect this hour, the effect on our character, our culture, our constitution. Can we ever shake this ghost? 800-423-8255 is the way to join the conversation. Chas Freeman, our guest, is an independent strategist, a writer, a business advisor after a long and sparkling career in government. 40-plus years ago, he was the best Chinese speaker in the State Department, and so he became the interpreter in all of the Kissinger-Nixon exchanges with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai in the historic opening to China. He also became fluent in Arabic and Middle East politics. He served as George H.W. Bush's ambassador to Saudi Arabia and as Bill Clinton's assistant defense secretary. You're well-known now, Ambassador Freeman, for speaking your own mind, and we're delighted to have you on Open Source. Give us your narrative of what happened on 9/11 and what you would have said on, you know, 9/12.
Well, it's a privilege to be with you. What happened on 9/11 is that we should have learned that when we bomb people or injure them, they find a way to bomb back or injure us. And a terrorist is basically just somebody with a grudge and no air force. We should have reflected on why this happened. Instead, we responded with a blast of self-righteous declarations that it happened because they hated our values, which was not correct. It happened because they hated what we were doing.
Where and what? And who?
Well, partly our support for Israel and its oppression and annexation of Palestinian land. Partly our presence, as Steve Pinker said, in the holy areas of Islam in Saudi Arabia. Not entirely accurate perception, but still a source of distress. Partly our support for dictatorial governments that lack popular support in the region. Many things, but overall, the point is that from the perspective of those who committed these atrocities, and they certainly were atrocities, this was an act of reprisal. It was not something irrational or just a lashing out at the United States and the American people.
What about an even simpler definition that these were our soldiers of fortune, Osama bin Laden and others? These were our sepoys who we left high and dry after the fall of the Soviet Union, and that they had a score to settle. A very specific score.
Well, I don't
score.
Think that was their optic at all. Certainly, we danced with the devil. We funded, we armed, we trained Islamic militants. We enlisted religion in the struggle against communist ideology and the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. But I don't think that was their issue. Their issue with us was not Afghanistan or our abandonment of them. Although I think, frankly, once the Soviet Union had left Afghanistan, we lost all interest in it, and we failed to see that it might yet become important to our own interests directly. And we left it to take its own course. And it eventually became a refuge for anti-American terrorists with global reach. The Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda group that was there sponsored the planning effort, which took place mainly in Germany and in the United States, and which was executed in the United States. I don't think I'd quite agree with your characterization.
Well, I was putting it as a question. Where do we find ourselves today in the hypersecurity consciousness and in the many reactions, including, you know, Homeland Security and many other things, the Patriot Act, in response? And I'd also love you to put it in perspective, in a historical perspective of the ways that the Civil War or the Depression or the Cold War changed ourselves, our sense of ourselves, even our government.
Well, I think we had an opportunity after the end of the Cold War to reinvent ourselves. And indeed, in the election of 1992, there was some talk about that, mainly from Ross Perot, whom everybody discounted. It was picked up by Al Gore, but instead of going for the jugular when he became vice president, he went for the capillaries. And the effort to reinvent government got nowhere. But it was a sound concept. Periodically throughout history, in response to trauma, the Civil War, which you mentioned, the Depression, the Cold War, we have renegotiated the compact of governance. We've changed the relationship between the government and the people, between the federal government, the center, and the states, and between ourselves and the outside world. That certainly was what happened in the Civil War. The federal government after the Civil War bore no resemblance to the one before, and it happened in the Depression, and it happened in the Cold War, too, which was conducted under a conception of grand strategy that George Kennan put forward in 1946 and 47 of containment. And it was such an effective political, economic, and cultural, and informational, and military strategy that we essentially coasted on it for 40-some years. And when it succeeded, finally, we'd forgotten what it was all about. In any event, along came Bill Clinton with the slogan, "It's the economy, stupid," which wasn't very responsive to the reinvention of government that the end of the world order defined by the Cold War invited. And it was left to George W. Bush in 2001 in response to 9/11 to renegotiate the compact of governance, change the relationship of the government to the people, change the relationship of the federal government to the states, and alter our relations with the outside world. And he seems to have created something quite permanent, not just a Department of Homeland Security, a garrison state, a surveillance apparatus that is increasingly all-pervasive, and a foreign policy which is aggressively militaristic, but a change.
Those are scary words, something quite permanent. Keep going.
Well, I think we all expected, hoped, or feared, depending on one's point of view, that Barack Obama's election would change this. But instead of producing change that we could believe in, as he promised, it produced change we can't even detect. The continuities are striking. In many ways, he's doubled down on aspects of the surveillance state that his predecessor created.
He's also given us a kind of a popular fear of a deep state in which the elected president is, as they say, this is the politics is the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex, and nasty thoughts like that. But spell it out, especially the could be permanent piece of it.
Well, people are talking about the deep state now. I take that to be the constitutional order. That's what I'm talking about in terms of renegotiating the terms of the Constitution without changing its text. I think we've done that. And I think we now have a military-industrial congressional complex. And we have to remember that in Eisenhower's original draft of his farewell address, he had military-industrial congressional complex. And for political reasons, he omitted the congressional when he actually delivered the speech. But his first formulation, I think, was very accurate. And we now have a similar apparatus acting in this field of counterterrorism. That is to say, an industrial complex, a group of companies, consultants, a whole range of activities, a government department that is very well funded, the Department of Homeland Security, and its subordinate agencies, which all live off generating fear of terror. So we have signs on the roads that tell us to report our fellow citizens or anything strange. We have alerts of various colors. Every time we go through a gate at the airport, we pay unconscious obeisance to the memory of Osama bin Laden. We take off our shoes and bow our heads to the TSA. You know, this is really quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. So also was that, I mean, it's tempting to think of your what might have been a moment of reinvention. But the reinvention, as you suggest, is all been done ad hoc. Most of it started under the Bush administration. But now we know it includes any number of CIA black sites all over the world, target killings, roving wiretaps, the whole nightmare of the security establishment. And as you say, it pays. It's a rich industry. Steve Pinker, I mean, it's a darker story than the one you had first outlined.
Yeah, I'm not happy about a lot of the things that have happened, but I guess I'm not worried. I don't think we're on the edge of totalitarianism.
I don't think we are either, but I would point out that we have created the mechanisms by which totalitarian state could be imposed on a moment's notice. We have created a prefabricated totalitarian state in terms of the surveillance apparatus, the law enforcement apparatus, the militarization, the executive authority without judicial constraint. You know, the idea that the president can order the death of an American citizen without any judicial review or due process is quite remarkable. We've laid down the basis for a totalitarian state, and you have to have a much greater confidence in human nature than I have to think that it's impossible that someone won't come along and decide that we need to actually use what we've built to do that.
Steve Pinker.
Yeah, it seems to me that the really totalitarian states in the past and the ones in the present do it with a fairly primitive technological infrastructure. Informants, a judiciary that's willing to indict people on trumped-up corruption charges or, in the case of Malaysia, sodomy charges. I worry much more about the kind of moral panics that would allow prosecutors and judges and juries to throw people in jail than what I consider kind of more of a Keystone Cops effort by National Security Agency to just vacuum up as much data as possible, data that they have no idea what to do with.
Aren't they doing it?
The metadata from the National Security Agency? What have they actually done with that? I mean, is anyone actually in jail because of it?
No, but I think that's what Charles Friedman means about a sort of a turnkey, is waiting for the key.
It seems to me that, here we have a country now where you can be thrown in jail on the basis of evidence that you're not allowed to see, on the basis of testimony by witnesses you cannot confront, because it's the doctrine of secret evidence, which is a post-Cold War innovation, is now ubiquitous. We've got a scandal going in Washington at the moment where the head of the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee has accused the CIA of spying on her committee. And also trying to use the Department of Justice to intimidate its staff. One has to be quite concerned about this. You can be held without charge indefinitely, apparently. You can be killed on executive order. You can be jailed, detained, and tried on the basis of charges the exact nature of which is not explained to you on the basis of evidence you can't see. This is a very, very far way from the country that our founding fathers envisaged.
And it's strange also that it's so long after 9/11, isn't it?
Well, these things have a momentum. Just as in the military sphere, threat analysis is the best justification of budgets. Fear of terrorism is a justification of budgets and expediency in other realms.
Can I just change the imagery a little bit? Is something else that sort of I wonder where we're going when I read in the papers that a new Defense Department program has offered 13,000. Armored vehicles, tanks really, to law enforcement all around the country, virtually free of charge. Tanks mounted with machine gun turrets. They're designed to counter IEDs in Iraq. A lot of them, though, end up in small town America. Keene, New Hampshire has one. Oxford County, Maine has one. Massachusetts General Hospital has one from time to time. I'm not quite sure why. Not exactly terrorist targets that we know of. But we know there's a profit in here somewhere, and also that these things have a momentum of their own. What's driving it, Charles Friedman? What drives that kind of distribution?
Well, a good deal of that is just driven by the fact that there are federal programs that you can apply for money for. You can go and you can get money to deal with terrorism. And actually, it's really extraordinary. Right after 9/11, there were when the Department of Homeland Security was first being conceived, there were 28 sites identified in the United States that needed special protection because they might be the target of terrorists. And when money became attached to this, when you could apply for a federal funding to protect a site, that ballooned to very quickly over a two-year period to something like 56,000 sites, including the Indiana Pork and Apple Festival.
Yes, and Weeki Wachee Springs in Coral Gables, Florida. Yes.
Yeah.
No, it is quite absurd, and it's because of all that federal money sloshing around.
Money is an incentive, as we all know, to do things. In this case, it's an incentive to hype threats.
Yes, but it's also, we as consumers of journalism and as producers of journalism also have to not stoke up the terror by endless coverage of fairly minor terrorist events and also the what might be unreasonable demands of why didn't the government connect the dots and see this happening. I think a lot of the measures are bureaucrats covering their anatomy, thinking that if something happens, they're going to be the ones on the hook, and doing anything that they can think of, however ineffectual, as long as it looks as if they are protecting us against the next threat. So we can't.
That's exactly right.
So you know, we have to also realize that some terrorist attacks will happen. It won't be possible to connect the dots. And if we hold government accountable to preventing every attack, then they're just going to do anything they can think of to go through the theater of protecting us.
I got to ask you, but it's an important question for a short answer. 56,000 potential terrorist targets, 13,000 tanks for your local police department. How does a war on terror of this sort come to an end? Or does it just bankrupt us and we flop over dead and start again?
Well, in effect, you know, the idea of a war on terrorism, which is what was proclaimed, is absurd. It's like a war on guns. It misdefines the issue, and it can never end if it's defined that way. Mm-hmm. And the search for absolute security for the society ends up producing absolute insecurity for the individual.
Well, it might also be the deficit hawks that realize how much money is being wasted that shut it down from the right.
Yesterday, we spoke with the writer Pico Iyer. I think of him as our eyes and ears on the global culture. Indian parents, boyhood in England, college and citizenship now in the United States. He's married to a Japanese woman. His base is rural Japan, but his career is traveling to all the far places. We caught him on a Skype phone on a visit with his parents in Santa Barbara, California. I asked Pico Iyer how America is looking to the rest of the world in this post-traumatic time.
I do feel, as many of us do, that our country's grown more and more isolated from the world in the last 13 years. And even as we're living in an ever more connected globe, we can sometimes seem in this country to be more disconnected than ever. And so it strikes me that whenever I go to an interesting country, I meet Germans and Canadians and Brits and Israelis and Australians and pretty much the entire world, including more and more Chinese, and almost never an American. And it worries me that in this global neighborhood, where, as in any neighborhood, the first sensible thing is to go and get to know the neighbors, we seem to be further and further from the world at large. And I think the effect here seems to be fear and greater distance. And, you know, I think the U.S. is obviously a young country, and it's a very charmed country. And I'm chosen to live here because I think it's a remarkable privilege that we have had and I've had to spend, let's say, 50 years without a war around us at home. And I think there must be very few people in all of history who could say that they've enjoyed that great blessing. Part of our problem is, because of this isolation, not having a sense of history and not having a sense of geography very much. It struck me that I was flying to Canada the week of September 11th. And the minute I touched down in Ottawa, everyone around me was putting that terrible event into a global context and into a historical context. Of course, Canada wasn't the direct target of the attack, so maybe it was a little easier for them. But nonetheless, I wish that we were in a position to see isolated events as not isolated, but as part of a larger kind of sequence of cause and effect.
That was the writer Pico Iyer. There's a lot more of our conversation with Pico on our website, radioopensource.org. Our phone is 800-423-8255 to join the conversation with Ambassador Charles Freeman, the diplomat and strategist, and the psychologist Steve Pinker of Better Angels and the way the mind works, or how the mind works. Could we talk about culture? And how all of this, whatever it is reflected in our books and movies and television, or not. Steve, you're a culture buff. Among the buffs.
The aspect of culture that I have to pay attention to is language. One of the things I do is serve as the chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, which every edition, every 10 years or so, adds maybe 10,000 new words and senses. The editors have to decide which of the many new catchphrases and jargon terms are permanent enough to be immortalized in the dictionary. And one of your listeners sent sent us a list of several hundred new terms that have become common since 9/11.
Appalling, yeah.
Weapons of mass destruction, axis of evil, evildoers, suicide bomber, underwear bomber, green zone, IED, checkpoint insurgency. I think
stress position.
Stress position, coalition of the willing, shock and awe. I'm sure some of these will make it in. Some of them might be too ephemeral, but the language really is a barometer of the things that are on our minds and on our tongues.
Let's give Oliver Krangel's parrot credit for that list. The parrot, and it's on our website too. But what does it tell you?
Well, it's this is only a fraction of the new words that have come into circulation. The language is constantly welcoming new words, and Abrahamic as a descriptor of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, air rage, bubble tea, cojones. There are just literally thousands of new words, and only a fraction of them make it into the dictionary. So the things that are on our minds, we invent new words for, so that we don't have to go through a laborious circumlocution every time.
Pico Iyer made a very different point that I found intriguing, and it's in what you can hear on the website, but simply that the culture in many, many ways, definitely Hollywood, may be well ahead of the public conversation, certainly the political conversation. Movies, he cited Syriana, for example. I parried with Captain Phillips. I thought that was a terrifically interesting reflection on, might and main of American armed forces confronting an utterly different century, different planet of outrage and human power in that movie. I thought even Gravity could be filed under the sort of reconsideration of who we are trying to get home from the distance. But also, it's a detail but an important one, that the Hollywood requires big foreign rights and foreign profits. They are selling to a world consciousness, and the global markets have a chance to vote on pop culture as they don't on our Congress or our president. And they may be well ahead of the game of where we're all going eventually.
Well, except that the requirement that they make a lot of their money overseas means that they can't rely on too much that is English-specific. And so the golden age of movies with witty banter and wordplay has been eclipsed by visual-driven movies where it will play well in a culture that's not going to grasp the nuances of English. So for those of us who love language in movies, it's a bit of an unfortunate development.
The phone is 800-423-8255. We're talking about the post-9/11 condition, whatever we call it. Are we stuck in it? Is it forever? Is it going to change us in an essential way? Frank is calling from Boston.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Welcome, Frank.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be on air with the ambassador there and all the wonderful points that he's brought up about the security apparatus and how, we're just waiting for the key to be turned. And that's kind of to the point that you've been making, Chris, about how, are we suffering from PTSD? I would argue that perhaps we're suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, where we have come to, love our captors that are, applying all of these draconian measures against us as citizens and telling us that everything will be okay and the terrorists won't get you as long as you comply to everything that we tell you to do. And how really all that amounts to a security theater, where we're not actually able to stop with this huge security apparatus. We're not able to stop somebody that wants to do harm to other people. It's just not possible. And so I think we need to come to a realization that freedom is messy and that bad things are going to happen to good people. And that's just the world we live in. And are we willing to give up everything that we fought for to be free in order to have a little bit of a sense of security and stability in the world? And
that sounds like a student of yours, Chaz Freeman. Frank, you're good. Thank you. Chaz Freeman?
Thank you very much for the time.
Well, I agree with that. And I think it's sad that we're not prepared to accept a measure of risk as part of life. Because if we aren't, then we're going to be entirely the prisoners of our own fears. And I think, going back to the discussion of films earlier, that in a sad way, since I do a great deal of traveling abroad, I think our films appeal abroad because they confirm increasingly negative stereotypes about us. that we're very good at blowing things up and not very good at thinking or doing things by non-coercive means. Or that we make foreign policy decisions without considering the interests or views of foreigners at all.
That sounds like Pico's line that we don't have a context, we don't have a geography, much less a history in our
heads.
We
don't teach geography in this country anymore.
We also, I think, fail to appreciate how unusual the United States is among the world's democracies. When I point out that democracies are less likely to go to war than autocracies, people say, what about the United States? But the United States is one of the world's least typical democracies. By a lot of measures, we're really out there. We have a greater degree of religious belief. We have a much greater rate of personal violence than the typical Western democracy. We have less of a social safety net. We have a gun culture that is quite unknown elsewhere in the world. And we do tend to get involved in more than our share of wars compared to other democracies. So the United States is one weird democracy.
Ambassador Freeman, I didn't hear you out entirely on the whole cultural touchstone. For example, on the there's a thought out there that it's remarkable that there's no giant book of a sort of Victor Hugo proportions or even Norman Mailer proportions about 9/11. There's not even a complete government account. I mean, 28 pages of our official statement to ourselves about what happened have been redacted. There's no giant movie kind of explaining or presenting or documenting in a persuasive way what this story is about. Do you want to comment on the cultural piece, Mr. Ambassador?
I'm not sure that I have much to say. I've noted that with some distress that it's been quite a long time since an American won a Nobel Prize for Literature. And
Philip Roth is still hoping.
But I wonder whether our literature, in fact, doesn't reflect the sort of peculiarities that Steve Pinker was talking about. And whether, or for that matter, Pico Iyer, and whether we're not, in a sense, isolated culturally much more than we realize. We're certainly not very aware, and I was very struck after 9/11. My assumption, which proved to be completely wrong, was that the attacks of 9/11 would cause Americans to want more information on foreign realities and trends. And instead, after a while, there was an effort made by the media to fill that supposed need, but it failed. There was no demand. And I remember the Pew Trust did a poll which concluded that the reason there had not been increased demand for foreign information about the outside world was that Americans didn't feel they had enough background to understand it. So they just tuned it out. And to a great extent, we seem to have replaced inductive reasoning about the world with narratives, with presuppositions, which we don't examine, in many cases because the presuppositions are politically correct or convenient, and to question them subjects one to vilification or denigration by the public. And so many people who might speak out remain silent.
I just want to put in a word for Hollywood there, and again, it's Captain Phillips, but I mean, somebody who sort of looked into the eyes of that Somalian pirate has seen something of the other world, and in some depth, I think. Anyway, how do we?
Well, that's a good film, but of course, it is a Hollywood film, and if you compare the story there with what actually happened, it doesn't quite coincide, I think.
Ambassador Freeman, I want to say I think there would be a big appetite out there somewhere for a let's reinvent this baby. World conference. We could, even get Ross Perot back, get Al Gore back, get the people back. I think you might have to, shove the Congress and maybe the executive branch aside. But I think people could welcome a kind of constitutional convention.
I suspect they might. And yet, I think there's a justified fear that the Constitutional Convention might actually reaffirm many of the most objectionable features of
you'd have parties trying to redefine the U.S. as a Christian nation. You'd open all kinds of
but they'd get shouted down after a long weekend, I'm sure.
I wish I could be sure. And I don't think we're at our most thoughtful as a country.
800-423-8255 is our phone. Join the conversation with Chaz Freeman and Steve Pinker. Can I just throw out two names? One Steve knows vastly better than I, but the missing heroes in this story that we could wish to summon. One is William James, the great psychologist, witnessing the Civil War and saying, hey, let's not do that again. Where's that spirit? Who's embodying that kind of pragmatism that made James immortal after the Civil War? The whole idea of embodying the idea that we judge policies, we judge ideas themselves by their effects, by the fruits, not the roots, with transparency, with an experimental spirit, and then accountability. That mindset has never been brought to, you know, what happened at 9/11. The other one I just want to nominate is an Englishman, of course, an Irish Englishman, Edmund Burke, a conservative hero who made a long, hard campaign in Parliament to impeach Warren Hastings for his rule of India and for the pillage and rape and racism that he brought to the job. He wanted to hold Hastings responsible, as he said, Burke said, for the disgrace of the British character in India. He was the conscience of an empire. We're the empire now, but without, we don't have a conscience saying the things you can't do. And there's a respect that all people and all nations must have. It sounds more like what you were saying, Chaz Freeman, but what other ways are there to get us out of this trough? Steve? Yeah.
Well, William James is wrote that wonderful essay, The Moral Equivalent of War, and reading it now, one is struck by what he had to argue against, namely the idea that war was inherently holy, heroic, manly, invigorating, healthy, that any society that gave up war would become effeminate, slothful, consumerist, hedonistic. And James actually accepted that framing, and his moral equivalent of war was a kind of Peace Corps compulsory service, send kids to mines and on fishing ships and factories so they could be toughened up in the same way that war would toughen them up without having to kill anyone. But it's a kind of rhetoric you don't hear anymore, even when wars are justified. You don't hear it as something that is inherently healthful and that our society will become too effeminate unless we go to war every once in a while just for the sake of it. So it does show a kind of progress that argument strikes us as absurd now.
Chaz Freeman, do you want to play the...
On the other hand, we treat war as a sort of video game or perhaps as a professional sport. We're the fans. We have a professional army which goes out and fights. We revel in its trickery, its technology, and we don't show the people it's killing. We don't tally their numbers. We worry about the numbers of our own dead. We don't seem to worry much about the numbers of our own wounded, who are legion since modern medicine. And medevac techniques can save huge numbers of people for a miserable life after the battlefield.
But fewer are killed and injured than in past wars, such as Vietnam. So I think there is some progress there.
Chaz Freeman, I didn't have time, but I want to invite you to play the Edmund Burke role.
He's a hero of mine.
That's fascinating. Didn't know that. Thank you for being with us. Ambassador Chaz Freeman, thank you, Steve Pinker. Thanks also to Pico Iyer, whom we spoke with yesterday. There's a longer version of our conversation with Pico on our website, radioopensource.org. There are also lots of other features on the language and the look of post-9/11 world, and a lot of great conversations underway. Our show is produced by Max Larkin and Kunal Jasti. George Hicks is our radio engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.